Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fireside Chat number 321. I'm Dennis Prager. And a few times a year, very few, I have a guest. Nearly all the Fireside Chats are just you and I. Is it are just you and I or are just you and me? Now, I know most people don't care, but I do. In any event, on occasion, I have a guest. And this is a special guest, as it were. Well, it is a special guest. If I'm interested in a public figure, I'm interested in the people in their lives and their family specifically. So I have two sons, and I'm going to have as my guest today one of my sons, my younger one, Aaron Prager, and he was born in 1992. By the way, does that make you a millennial? I have no idea how these terms are precisely defined. That's a millennial?
It would be millennial. I'm pretty sure that Gen Z starts 95.
Oh, really? There's an actual date.
Yeah.
That's that. Okay. So you made the millennial crowd.
Yeah.
Aaron has a very, very interesting story. I am of the opinion that a good biographer could make anybody's life interesting. I do believe that. But clearly, some people have lived more for good and for ill than others have. Aaron has had a very intense life. Is that fair to say?
It's an understatement in some regards and overstatement in others.
Okay, that's fair. And I will also be noting by the end of the podcast that Aaron has started a podcast, but he has not used his last name. He has wanted to make it on his own. So this is a debut of announcing your podcast. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, there. I'm sure we'll get into it more, but there is definitely an element that I wanted to, and it goes hand in hand with the fact that I am 7.5 years in recovery, that there, when I did get sober, I needed to separate myself from the Prager last name, if you will, to create my own identity, learn who I was, and ultimately through my recovery program, gain a new relationship with God. And going into now wanting to have a content creation / podcast / YouTube channel that is focused on modern topics, cultural topics, as well as the more religious topics. I needed to separate from the Prager last name, get that under control, prove to myself that I have self-worth aside from it.
Well, that's very admirable. You did not bank on a last name. And I've been watching all of your podcasts and feel it is a propitious time to go public, because I find them really good. We'll talk about that later. I want to talk about your life and your outlook on a number of issues. So why don't we begin, since you already began with recovery? So let's tell the basic story of you and alcohol and drugs.
Okay. I think the place to start is, and something that I feel a lot of people can relate with who are alcoholic, drug addicted as well, is the feeling of, I remember the first time I got sufficiently intoxicated, I said to myself, I want to feel like this every single day. And I chased that feeling ultimately to the gates of, you know, in recovery circles, you say untreated, you end up in one of three places: jails, institutions, and death. And I was knocking on that last one very close.
So I have learned an immense amount about addiction from you. Your openness is a big part of your appeal. And this will, I think, will help a lot of people who know somebody who is addicted, as well as those who are. So that was, I didn't interrupt you, but that was like sort of a revelation to those of us who have not had this issue. You knew from the first time, this is a great feeling.
Yeah, it was as if, you know, people talk about when they achieve certain milestones in their life, they're like, I've arrived. right? I've arrived at my destination. This is what I was building towards. This is what I needed. This is what I enjoy ultimately. That was the same thing when it came to me and alcohol. Now, my story includes other substances as well, but alcohol was my main vice. I had to have it at all costs and would neglect every other aspect of my life to be able to pursue what I really wanted. In a way, alcohol became my solution to my problem. And I know it's weird for a lot of people to hear that because they think, oh, if you take the bottle away from the alcoholic, their lives tend to get better. In my experience, and I'm gonna jump forward a second, is when I did get sober and I didn't have, now sober and recovery, I differentiate between the two. We'll get into that. I was more miserable sober than I was drinking because I had lost my solution to enable me to at least get through the day.
Now, you explained to me a long time ago why alcoholism is called a disease. Because a vast number of people don't see it that way. They see it, I guess, in a more judgmental way as a flawed behavior. You gave me a great way of understanding how biologically based it is and not just psychologically or even morally based. You take 10 people and you give them a drink. A certain number of the 10 will yearn for more. Is that correct? Is that the analogy you gave me?
Yeah, it's the rough analogy is it was the differentiating between, let's say, because I think you would ask me, given the opioid crisis, is between heroin and opiates and alcoholism. And I, while there is physical components to the both of them, the psychological components do play a huge part as well. And I got to preface, I'm not a doctor. I don't have a PhD in this. This is stuff I heard from other recovering alcoholics that I've seen apply in my life and the people around me. And it's 10 people who you put them in a room with heroin. 10 out of 10 are going to come out addicted to heroin usually after a week because they're using, you know, a substance that creates such a violent withdrawal. Alcohol after 10 days, right? Not enough to develop a physical addiction to it. Probably 1 out of 10 will come out truly alcoholic. And that's, at least in my case, I was that one person where I found my mental solution. I found my spiritual solution, actually, in the form of alcohol.
That's a powerful statement. I would not have been that one. And why not? The answer is physiology. So fine. Now the fact.
I will say this real quick is, I don't know. There are arguments on both sides whether there's biological components or there aren't biological components. But I, at least from my experience, can understand. You know, I am adopted. I met my biological birth mother at 23 years old in the thralls of my addiction, and it just so happened that we had the same two drugs of preference. And the first time we ever met each other, we used them together. So I can't explain that. Other than there has to be some form of biological component to it.
Right. So you were born to a meth addict.
Yes, I was.
That's not insignificant. I wasn't. My mother was addicted to my father. And I wasn't addicted to my father either. That's a separate issue. Okay. Back to you. So these are two of the biggest issues I want to talk to you about. So since you raised it, and obviously I would have raised it. We both believe that openness helps people. I think I've told this joke, but it's not a joke. Guy called my radio show and said, "Dennis, I have a one-word description of you." And I'm thinking, uh-oh. But I go, "Okay, what is it?" And he goes, "Transparent." And I thought, yeah. You're right, and I want to be transparent. And you have a very similar view. You don't hide yourself and your experiences from people. Obviously, this is a lot of people, and this is a good example of it. So, let's talk about the adoption. Your late mother and I adopted you the day you were born. And by the way, I just want to make this point. I know I'm sure you've heard me say it, but when people say, oh, can you love non-blood as much as blood, adopted as much as biological, I go, well, I have a million answers to that. We should do a whole fireside chat on that subject because I have such passion on this subject. I've so found it irrational. First of all, you've never heard this one from me. This is one of my newer arguments.
Be one of the few I haven't heard.
Yeah, there would be one of the few. And in fact, I may be wrong, but you'll tell me. How much do people love their dog? Nobody is biologically related to their dog. And they love their dog. They cry when the dog dies. And then they ask, gee, how do you really love an adopted child? Wait, you love your dog, but I'm not going to love my child? There's such unclear thinking on the matter. Also, as a man, I don't carry a child. And so when did I first see my biological son, your brother? The day he was born. When did I first see you? The day you were born. So from my perspective of seeing my baby, there is no difference just even in that regard. Okay, so I get very passionate on the issue. Okay, so I've never asked you this publicly, and I don't even know what answer you'll give. Did you ever feel that I loved David more than you?
Whew, that's tough.
Not based on who gave me a harder time in life because of your addiction and so on. Based on adopted versus biological.
Okay, so it's a bit of both, but there were times where I did. The short answer is yes. There were times where I felt that you loved David more. But here's the thing with that: it was based on zero evidence. There was no evidence surrounding it. It was 110% an emotional feeling that I have no doubt was fueled by my own combination of self-loathing and because it did crop up when I was in my early stages of drinking and over partying. And it's something I want to clarify too, is I don't know when it switched from being a teenager who went to parties to being an addiction. I don't know when it happened. I can't pinpoint the moment, but I remember when I was there. When I got there, I woke up one morning, I was like, uh-oh. And a lot of the things that accompanied that were exactly as you said, thinking out of nowhere, my father loves my brother more than me because I'm adopted. Mm-hmm. I could take a postmortem on it and look back now and be like, well, I clearly know what that was. That was my lower power talking, edging my higher power out of my life. But at the time, I had no idea. It was as real as seeing something manifested right in front of my eyes.
Though there was no, which I'm very touched that you even said, there was no evidence for it.
There was none.
Right, because it doesn't exist.
Correct.
Yeah. I so believe this openness, which is not easiest for people, but for us, but is helpful for people because so many people go through stuff like this. So you met your birth mother at 23 and... I'm laughing, but it's not funny. I'm laughing because it enters the realm of the absurd. You meet your birth mother for the first time, and you both share what? Meth?
Yeah, I drank the whole way on the flight from LAX up to Washington State. Met her, and so I was already sufficiently intoxicated on the way back to what I didn't know was a trailer at the time. On our way back there, we stopped at the liquor store and then we get to the house and I want to mention something about this too that ties into with adoption and our life down here is when she picked me up at the airport and asked me, should we stop at the liquor store on the way? That was a moment, and this is the addiction talking, just to show it, to illustrate the insanity behind it. When she asked me that, at the time, emphasize that just at that time, I felt more connected to her than I had ever to you because she asked me if I wanted to drink with her. And that is something that I think people need to understand about addiction is that there is nothing, zero, nada, that is based in fact for the most part that goes on between the alcoholic's ears, the active alcoholic's ears. It's made up. It's driven by emotion and that hole in the soul that's left. So she brings me back to the trailer. And she goes to the back, and I smelled something familiar, and I heard a familiar noise. And the bathroom was essentially a curtain that just you open and close, you know, and there was the toilet there. And I looked down, and she had a meth pipe. And I was like, I'm home. I'm home. Mm-hmm. Growing up in this. And then I go to a rundown trailer in the boonies of Washington State, and I'm home. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, maybe you don't know what I mean, but.
I do know. Of course I do. No, you're so clear. God, that's not something I had heard from you, this exact reaction. So when you came back to LA, were you feeling, what a bummer, I wish I had grown up with her?
I was so all over the place mentally with things that I could be 100% convicted of, like, I'm doing this right now. 30 seconds later, I'm on to the next thing. So while I've had that it sounds like the way I described it and the way it was this profound feeling. Like, it was like light had opened up and I was like struck. But even that, I get back to LA, I'm concerned about when's my next pickup? How am I going to get well? How much money do I have left? You know, I didn't do laundry. I didn't do coin laundry because I didn't wash my clothes because it would detract from my using money. You know, and that's what it was. So I was too wrapped up with other things than to be like, oh yeah, well, you know, I should go back there. You know,
when you speak, I think how anybody who is addicted can take you seriously. I always wonder, do people who counsel addicts, if they have not been addicted themselves, can they ever really be as effective as an ex-addict?
100% they can. I ran into this when I was counseling teenagers, and I'm really glad you asked this. It's like saying it's the comparison I would give them, because we did have counselors that were not in recovery themselves. And they would go out, and, you know, I'd talk with the other counselors, you know, and, you know, candidly, you know, we're not around patients, and they'd be like, oh yeah, I went out to the bar, you know, on the weekend, got so drunk, you know. And then the kids, when they're trying to, or the teenagers, I should say, when they're meeting with the counselors, they would come up to me and be like, Aaron, I can't trust so-and-so because, you know, they just can't relate to me, you know, but it's an excuse, obviously. But the line I'd give them is saying, do you think a brain surgeon can't do his duty because he never had brain surgery? Do you think, substitute any profession, they can't do it because they haven't been on the opposite end of it themselves? Now, don't get me wrong, there's inherent value in one addict/alcoholic helping another person. I mean, that's the whole basis of 12-step recovery, is one addict helping another, one alcoholic helping another person, because there is inherent value that they know that, if someone, I'll give you an example. For me, a lot of the time when I would try to explain what I was feeling or what my thought, like what was going on in my life, I felt like they were, like I was speaking English and they were speaking Russian back to me. Like I didn't, there was a disconnect. But then something happened when I went to a certain 12-step philosophy or program that I don't name due to the traditions. Plumbers, electricians, people from every background of the socioeconomic background, they all spoke the same language as I did. So there was a connection there.
Yeah, so it all makes sense. But someone can still effectively counsel addicts if they were not themselves addicted.
100%.
So, yes, I appreciate that fact. So there is now a movement of, you don't need the 12-step program, you don't need AA, you don't need a higher power, you don't need God. What do you think of these movements? And by the way, do you know if they're getting big?
Okay, so that's a multi-part question.
Right.
I can only speak to what I know for myself, and that is, I have thoughts though. I only speak to what I know for myself is that I am able to live a happy, joyous, and free life now. Granted, there's still pitfalls and things in my life that come up, because I went through a higher power based program that led me to an understanding, a spiritual solution to my problem. The fact that we live in a world now that is promoting, with this climate of opioid crisis and drug addiction, fentanyl coming across the southern border, killing off hundreds of thousands of people, that the proven program to help the most amount of people, and that's factual, we're going to step away from that because it talks about God? That's a disservice. You want to. There's a program, and that I'm not going to name, but it's all based on what is your rationale. Well, my rationale is I don't know my, you know, butt from my elbow, getting sober. I don't know how to live like this. And treatment centers are going to tell these people that they don't need the program that's been proven to work for so many people, if worked to the best of their ability.
It's another example of how secularism has been destructive. That's really, I hadn't thought of that, using that as an example.
And keep in mind too, these programs, they're not the programs that are higher power based. I say that very specifically because it isn't mentioning Judeo-Christian God necessarily. That's what I found my solution to ultimately. But my evolution of understanding of a higher power, granted, I was raised Jewish, right? We kept Shabbos. You took me to shul on Saturdays. Went to Jewish school. We founded a Jewish school. For me, I rebelled against that, ultimately, because it had to do with authority, which I was able to look back at. But my conception of a higher power has changed on multiple occasions through my journey in sobriety, and that's okay. I couldn't wrap my head around some benevolent being that, you know, is this loving God that is working in my life behind the scenes. What I was able to wrap my head around was, and to this man's great credit, he told me, is it can be anything other than yourself. It can't be you and it can't be me, because we're both humans and we're both fallible. It was the group of drunks, the acronym for God that I love the most, and also good orderly direction, group of drunks. The consensus of rooms of the recovery program I was in, I was hearing things that definitely I believe now was God speaking through other people that I needed to hear. I could never tell you a time when someone gave me an attaboy and I could remember it, but I could tell you almost every single time someone told me something in early recovery that made me want to punch them square in the head, but I needed to hear it. I could tell you almost every single one of those times. And that, to me, that was my original conception of a higher power, of God, if you will, was I needed the rooms. I needed the rooms of the program I went to in order to not revert back at the time, but that was, it's not sufficient to only do that, I might add.
Tell everybody, which I just learned when I had a dialogue with you in my synagogue this past Shabbat, the acronym EGO.
EGO. It's one of my favorites. This is not mine. I'm not going to take credit for it. EGO, edging God out.
That's perfect.
Yeah. And it's very applicable. The two fastest things that will take people out of their recovery program, at least from what I've seen, is ego and holding on to resentments. Mm. Those are the two things you hold. If you live in it for too long, it eats you up. A great thing for resentments is you drink. This is another thing that's not mine. Drinking poison, hoping somebody else dies.
I learned, as you know, the amount of wisdom in 12-step programs from callers to my radio show, because I never went through it, thank God. I would say to a caller, where did you come up with that wisdom? And they say, AA, 12-step. and after the 50th time, I started thinking, maybe 2 and 2 equals 4. Maybe to the point where I'll just say, I've now been really proven to be accurate. There is more wisdom at an AA meeting than at Harvard.
I've heard you say that before. I have heard you say that.
It's so true. It's not, I don't exaggerate. It sounds like a hyperbolic point. It is not at all. I believe that as sure as I'm sitting here talking to you. Now let's talk about hitting bottom. So again, I learned this from you. The people who turn their lives around, it's because they hit bottom. Is that a fair summary of your view?
Not necessarily, actually. I mean, I think it definitely helps to hit bottom. But I mean, a lot of people start their journeys through the legal system. You know, if they get a DUI or they commit a crime and they have to go to jail. You know, they don't necessarily want to be sober and live a life like that.
Well, jail is pretty much bottom.
But not for a lot of people, though. That's the thing. I mean, I went through some terrible things myself, up into and including suicide attempts. And that wasn't my bottom. It wasn't.
What was your bottom?
My bottom was when I looked around and I realized that I had no one left to blame for my problems.
Okay, just let me say, anybody watching this, it was worth it just for that. because that is applicable to everybody.
It is.
You recover your life when you stop blaming others. But so I've heard you say this, and I have not asked you this. Why does Aaron P. say, whoa, there's nobody left to blame, and Joe S. keeps blaming people? Isn't there something in you that should take credit for that realization?
People who don't believe in God will say one answer. I think that for me, my answer to this is God has always had my back throughout this process. There is no reason, and it was part of my recovery program that requires me to make an inventory of myself and then share it with another human being, God and it myself. I have to admit to another human being and ultimately God the nature of my wrongs. And within that, the amount of times I should have died, been in jail, whole host of other terrible things, it makes more sense to believe in anything than to believe in nothing. So it's hard to answer your question because I can only give you what I believe, which is that God has always worked in my life. There's been some force, okay, for people who don't like the G word, there was a force working in the world that had kept me alive to a certain point and enabled me to place the phone call to you to help getting me sober and to get me into a treatment center. I don't remember making that phone call.
That's amazing.
I've told you this before. I remember making this phone call whatsoever. So when you showed up at my door that one morning, I remember I asked you, I said, what are you doing here?
Right.
And you said, we're going to the airport. And once again, someone shows up at your house, right? Someone just shows up at your house saying you're going to the airport. The first question is, where are we going? Did I ask you where we're going? No, I went and I packed. So I can't explain that. Nor do I wish to understand that. I don't care. I give it up to God in that moment, and I run my life with a component of faith now, and that's how I'm able to see it. And there's also another little side note for all the people who are struggling with this who want to be like, oh, I have to nail down what God is. I have to understand God fully. If God is as great as we all, you know, everybody who's understanding of it is like, God is great. If he's that great, you're never going to fully understand it because you're a human and he's not. So take give yourself some credit for at least, you know, being on the journey, you know.
So now I'm going to ask you, I thought about this, the only question I thought about in advance, because I like spontaneity. So I have no idea what you'll say, and it's somewhat of a risk, but it's worth it. Could I have done anything different to get you into sobriety sooner?
No. That's the only answer I have is no.
Right.
And I'm not saying that to give you some sort of sense of anything.
I know your honesty. It's everybody knows if you felt there was, you would have said it. So then in light of your answer, let me just tell everybody. The place where you became sober ultimately in Pennsylvania, where you still live, by the way, you're visiting for the holidays. So you, and that's why this was possible. So you went there and they asked the significant people in the lives of any patient, is that the word patient?
Patient.
Yeah. In this place to come for a weekend. My desire to go to Pennsylvania, I didn't even see you basically. I mean, for 10 minutes maybe. My desire to go to Pennsylvania to hear lectures for a weekend was zero. But I felt I owed it to you, I owed it to me, I owed it to this the place that was working for you to do it. I went. Every talk was basically the same thing. And by the way, they were good. I want to give them credit. You can't do anything. The husband or wife, you the mother or father, you the son or daughter, you the friend, you the cousin, you the brother, you the sister. I mean, by the way, that's the relationship. I thought I would be there with basically all parents whose kids were there. I was in the minority. It was mostly adults whose brother was there or whose spouse was there. And their message was, they are the only people who can solve their problem. You can't. And that's what you're answering.
Yeah. I something that's interesting. So one thing I do want to point out, though, is the program initially at the treatment center, I was supposed to be, because I was 23, I was supposed to be in the young adult program. Thank God I was not in the young adult program, because they talked to me like I was an adult. And I had this, and this is how I ran my program when I was with, when I was working with teenagers. They almost wanted me to talk to them. They wanted me to talk to them a certain way. I refused to. You talk to them like an adult. Today's generation, especially of young people who are becoming addicted to substances, doesn't start with a lot of substances. It starts with they have the inability to emotionally regulate themselves, translates into societal pressures, translates into addiction. So when they get there, they're still mentally stunted, right? But what they need is a jumpstart, if you will. I'll talk to them the same way I would talk to you, or I would talk to any adult, with and almost to a higher degree of brutalness, because they don't need coddling anymore. I at least speak for myself, is when the last thing I needed was coddling. The more coddling I got, the more I felt like I could continue. And somebody asked us this on Saturday, was, you know, it had something to do, it had a lot to do with, you know, how do you fix these things? And my answer was, you have to stop. Society has to understand, has to hold two points simultaneously. One, that it is a disease, but two, you can't stigmatize the people who are within it. Treat them like adults. Tell them how it is. Be brutally honest with them.
I thought B was don't coddle.
Yeah, you don't coddle them. You don't coddle them at all. You talk to them as
I thought you were going to say A, it's a disease, but B, don't coddle.
Yes, there, well, yes,
if there's, people there's, think it's a disease, that. They think that you should coddle.
Well, I was going to get to that as well. Okay. That was the bookend to it,
right.
Which is you can't coddle the people within that. Society does, there is a huge stigma attached to people who are in addiction. I mean, when you first think addiction nowadays, now granted it's changed a little bit because of the opioid epidemic knocking off kids with three-car garages, but it's funny how people weren't really willing to admit that until that became the reality. Because opioids have been a problem for a very long time. Kids with three-car garages start dropping dead in mommy and daddy's house. Now it's an epidemic. Like, I went to a thing called Recovery Fest a few years back. There was only one of them. And I made a pledge that night to live in open recovery. But there's a lot of things that come along with that too. Society will see somebody who's an addict or somebody who's in recovery. And it's almost like they want them to drop the ball, the way society works now. Because if they could drop the ball, oh, defective character, you know, it's not a disease. Bad, you know, bad person, whatever. But when I made the pledge to live in open recovery, and I talk about it very honestly, and obviously I'm here today, there are things that come attached to that as well. If I'm going to bill myself as open in recovery, I have to live like I'm in recovery, if that makes sense.
What does open recovery mean?
It's to combat the stigma, to show that people, because a lot of people will get sober and be like, oh, society views, you know, addicts and alcoholics as these, like, you know, less thans, so I'm not going to talk about the fact that I'm in recovery.
Oh, open, being open about it.
Yes, it's called open recovery.
Right.
So I'm almost obsessed with trying to break the stigma surrounding these things, because I see time and time again, especially now with the way the opioid epidemic is, and it's not just opioids, I keep just mentioning that because that's what people know, but it's really all substances. Like, we live in a world where people are just trying to constantly escape from it. When I was in halfway house, I got a job making $10 an hour as a cook at a catering company. And my halfway house manager, I'm sure he doesn't have a problem with me saying it, Bobby Schwartz, I credit him with saving, one of the men who saved my life, said to me in so many words, don't F this up for all of us. And I took him seriously. Because what's going to happen if I was to do something wrong, if I was to embezzle from the company, if I was to do something less than they would, you know, give him a black eye, and then I'm getting, and then they would have to fire me. Chances are the person who gave me a shot at that company would never hire someone out of a halfway house again. So I'm responsible to put my best foot forward.
You talk about God's involvement. And if my hesitation is because theologically I'm torn on the issue, because I don't know when God intervenes or not for. But it does seem that God has had your back. And I'll give you an example, because you raised the issue of you weren't supposed to be in the adult program. Tell everybody you were put in the adult program, though you were under 23.
So I was supposed to be in the 18 to 25 group, and they didn't let them smoke cigarettes. And I basically, the one thing I do remember about this process of like talking about going to treatment was I saw that, said, you can't smoke. And I said, I'm not going to treatment if I can't smoke.
I, by the way, for the record, I found that stupid on their part.
I did too. I said this.
I mean, you're trying to get people off drugs and alcohol and they, you're banning cigarettes. Like that's, isn't that minuscule compared to drugs and alcohol?
100%. I pleaded with, I want to say this though. Working for the program I worked for, I had the greatest supervisor in the entire world. He was the most understanding guy in the world. He understood the needs of the teens and the population we were working with. But nonetheless, we did have our hands tied because it is a bigger, company. But I said to him on multiple occasions, I pleaded with him. I'm like, listen, if the kid's going through a hard time, these teenagers would go through real tough times. These young men would go through real tough times. I was like, all he wants is a cigarette. Just give him a cigarette and maybe he'll hear what we're trying to tell him.
Right.
But he cannot understand what's going on because he's so focused on nicotine, or give him a vape, something. And it's just like, we couldn't do anything about it. They sent like a pamphlet or something, I remember. And it said, this program does not allow smoking. And I said, well, I'm not going to a program if I can't smoke. Like, I'm a meth junkie. And most of these kids I'm going to be with are probably going to be like kids who are there smoking weed. Mommy and daddy won't give them the trust fund. And like, I'm one step away from being homeless. I weigh 92 pounds, soaking wet, a meth addict. Like, give me a cigarette or I'm not going. And then they bump me up.
Do you want to mention the rabbi who...
I don't know if he wants his name mentioned.
Okay, fine. Well, there was a Chabad rabbi who I have a theory that every human being has had angels in their life. I have, and he's one of those for you. There's no question, and obviously, therefore, for me. I just want to emphasize one more time, whenever you're asked what turned you around is when you decided you couldn't blame others for your issues.
It's when I looked around and
forgive me. I just want to make a macro point. That if I could dream up one solution to the problems of American society, that would be the solution. For everyone to wake up and go, others are not the reason for my unhappiness. I am.
Mm-hmm.
Not whites, not Christians, not heterosexuals, not patriarchy, not misogyny, me. That would solve everything overnight, just as it did ultimately for you. It's blame others for your unhappiness is the great tragedy of personal and social life in the country.
Well, there was something I realized too when it came to what you're talking about now, about it goes hand in hand with ingratitude in general. So if you're blaming other people, you're playing the victim. If you're playing the victim, what are a couple qualities that victims always have? They're unhappy and they're ungrateful, right?
Mm-hmm.
It all starts with, I think, with the issue of entitlement. And we live in one of the most entitled societies that we've ever lived in the history of the United States. Everybody feels like they deserve these things that they have not earned whatsoever. And furthermore, they suspect society to conform to them rather than them conform to society, right? So that's going to breed entitlement, which breeds victimhood, which breeds ungratefulness. And people who are ungrateful a lot of the time don't walk around happy. And as you always say, happiness is a moral obligation when you're around other people. It is. Moods are infectious. So if you're walking around entitled, a victim, ungrateful, unhappy, chances are you're going to act like a schmuck to the people around you. And you're going to start to create a society that's going to mimic that. It's going to mirror that, because then you're going to make other people unhappy and they're going to start. It's the inverse of almost pay it forward. Do something for somebody as an act. You're doing a negative act towards somebody. Hmm. Pay it forward benefits society because it could create a snowball effect. That's just the inverse of it. Some shoe on the other foot.
Let me remind people that this is the debut of announcing, because he has not wanted to start his podcast with his last name, which I deeply respected. How long is it? About a half year that you've been doing this?
I started June.
Yeah, so exactly a half year. Okay.
Yeah.
So I was right. Anyway, it's called AP Unfiltered. AP is for Aaron Prager, but nobody knew that. And Unfiltered, and it's one word, AP is attached to Unfiltered. And you talk about really everything. It's obviously not just recovery. And you talk about what's happening in the world.
Yeah, I talk about everything in the world. There is a heavier emphasis on current events, but I do tend to tie them into bigger things. So for instance, most of last week was Israel week. You know, I try to spread the Israel videos out as much as I can and what's going on, but I did a history of Hamas. I did the tunnels that the IDF discovered. You know, it was current events because I know people do want to understand that, but I try to, like I said, tie it into bigger concepts. And really what's happened since the summer is the double standard. That's such prevalent, blatant double standard that is occurring between the left and the right. Like, the rules for thee, not for me. But for the people who are scrolling through YouTube, scrolling through, you know, most of the people aren't on Rumble, even though I'm a big proponent of Rumble. People who are on YouTube, that's the battlefield. In my opinion, it's YouTube and Twitter. Those are X now. That's the battlefield. Get on there with good content, concise content, exposing the double standard, speaking from a rational perspective, and bringing the receipts to back it up. Bill Maher did a great job, and I'm not the hugest fan of Bill Maher. Bill Maher did a great job with his 8-minute monologue. That was fantastic. That was a video that I covered. YouTube did not like that video. But that was well done. Content like that, and what I feel my strength is putting that double standard in front of people in a way that you have to be clinically crazy to not at least give some sort of second look to. You might call me too much of an optimist in this regard, but I think I try to operate from the perspective of, like, people are not completely stupid yet, but yet, you know.
Yet, right. So tell us a little bit about your wife.
I love my wife. My wife is she's everything that I'm not and more. And that, I think, is what makes me stronger as a man. She's strong where I'm very weak, and she's able to work with me through my shortcomings in a way that doesn't make me feel less than. And I can appreciate that very much. I know a lot of marriages aren't like that. She does make me a better version of myself. She challenges me. I think every partner in life should challenge you to a healthy degree. She's from Pennsylvania as well. She doesn't necessarily struggle with a background in addiction like I do. But she did read the book, the different books of recovery, and specifically the one that I'm a member of. And to her great credit, when I did ask her to marry me, she had already found a pull to Judaism, and she ultimately converted. I didn't ask her. I said that to her. I remember you asked me, is your wife Felicia going to convert, or your girlfriend Felicia going to convert? And I was like, I'm not going to make her, you know. That wasn't the first thing in my mind, but I'm so glad that she did. I really am. From between her conversion, my refinding of faith in the Jewish faith, we have Shabbos dinner every night. She's arguably more religious.
Every Friday night.
Every Friday night. She's arguably more religious than I am in some regards. We keep kosher in our house. We don't eat, you know, treif, you know, pork products, shellfish, you know, we keep Torah kosher. And this is something that I've always wanted, to be able to create a home that was, and I'm going to preface this by saying, not to knock the house that I grew up in, but to have that plus more, and have the ability to do that when we have children of our own. And we're definitely on the path to get there. And that's why I'm smiling now, because I look forward to that so much.
You lit up when I asked you about Felicia. She is a gift, but you're a gift to her.
You know, I try.
Well, I think she would say that. What do you say to all the people of your generation who poo-poo marriage?
Oh, I have a lot of thoughts about this, actually. You've heard the term dink, double income, no kids.
Oh.
That's being put.
Are you familiar with it?
I didn't know.
Yeah,
okay. He reads a lot, so maybe
you're
it came
right. No, that was a fair question.
So double income, no kids, and this idea that I'm happy if we have money to travel, to, you know, eat out every night, do all these things. that to me, in like the shortest way I could say it, sounds so lame. It does. It sounds lame. It sounds boring. Maybe not at first, because you're going to be traveling and do all these crazy things. You're going to get bored, just like anything. I got bored shooting drugs, if that's even possible. I don't want to do it. I got bored doing it because I did it so often. Like, the point of vacation is to have vacation every once in a while and then take the people you love with you. So eventually, you're not going to have anybody. They're all going to pass away and you're going to be old and in a home, if you could even afford it at that point. I don't know. It sounds boring. It sounds lame. But at the same time, it makes sense why people are taking this route. It does make sense. And why I believe people are embracing this more and more and more, there's a component, well, ultimately, it's the edging God out of society. We don't live by traditional values anymore. We've taken, you know, community, which was the church. We've taken all these values that people have held, that held really close, that ended up building this country, thrown them out the window and replaced them with activism and all these purposelessness feeling or generating feelings that people now hold as their values. So of course, it doesn't surprise me that they're like, yeah, well, I'm not going to place a priority on having children and creating a family. Like, why do we want that? Down with the patriarchy. You know, that it's very, like, it's not rocket science, I should say.
And you want children.
Definitely.
Despite global warming.
Yeah, I mean, think about this. If Al Gore's prediction, which was supposed to be 2016, but now I think he's changed it, if that comes true and the polar ice caps melt, where I live in Pennsylvania, I'll have beachfront property. I'm good with it.
The case for living in Pennsylvania. That's right. Exactly. Hey, there's no beachfront property there now.
Nope.
It's a powerful thing. I feel beyond grateful for you and for how your life is now. And what can I say? I listen to you here. You're eloquent. You're mature. And I always say, I say to parents, tell me what you think about this. When I say this to parents, don't take too much credit for a good kid, and don't take too much blame for a bad kid. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're humans. We have our own agency. God gave us agency of ourselves. So it's like, all you can do as a parent, and granted, I'm not a parent yet, but this is what I've understood about parenthood from friends who are parents, from you, from learning a lot, is, and it's just a feeling that, like, I can never fully control my kid. Mm-hmm. I have to do what I believe is best to shape their values. Above all else, they act out, they do other things, that's on them. My experience has shown me they eventually will come around in one way or another. And for those who don't, it's a travesty. We know a lot of parents who have gone to college, and we talked to a lot of them recently. The kids are lost, being indoctrinated by the left, and this ideology that everything that has been the norm has now been blown up and flipped on its head. You say the left loves chaos. You know, what does it say in Genesis at the very beginning? God made order out of non-order. God made order out of chaos.
Any final thoughts, or you think we've done a good job?
No, I love coming out here to California to see you guys for Christmas. Emphasis on the Christmas. We love where we live.
By the way, the emphasis is on the Christmas, because we're all Jewish, but of course, my wife Sue's family is all Christian. Yes. Sue converted as well, as your wife did. And we make Christmas for them here, and you love her family.
Absolutely.
And they love you. And so I just wanted people to understand.
No, yeah. I mean, the emphasis on Christmas, we don't come out here very often, but we do enjoy when we do come. And ultimately, part of my amends process to you was, and you know, that's when I got through getting sober, and to tie it back into recovery, come full circle, is my amends to you was, one of the things I always did not do was show up when I was called upon to show up. I would make plans. I would be asked to show up places. Last minute, no, I gotta go to the bar or do other things. So part of my living amends to you, when I made amends to you, I remember 14 months sober, I came out to here, because you're supposed to do it face to face if you can. And I asked you, like, I told you what I did. I asked for what you did. He said, that was one of the things he said to me, was show up when called. And that's my living amends. And that's something that I have to do. So whether or not, like, and don't get me wrong, the flight across the country stinks. The drive to the airport stinks. Every part of the trip stinks, but it's worth it all to be here. And ultimately, to be allowed to be here is a blessing. You have to look it through. You have to look at life through the lens of, I get to do things. I don't have to do things. If people could just do that for one day, see how you feel. All the things you don't want to do, say, I get to do this today, rather than I don't want, then I have to do this. See how you feel.
You have something to say, Aaron. AP Unfiltered.
YouTube and on Rumble, AP Unfiltered, one word.
Well, I love when you visit, and I love visiting you in Pennsylvania. And I know you've already made a room for, God willing, kids.
Yes.
You've already picked out names.
We have. We're going to keep those to ourselves, though.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm not asking what they are. Well, God bless you. You're a joy in my life. See you next week.
Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.